This is our latest installment of If You Can Keep It. It's our weekly election series where we leave the horse race to the side. Instead, we focus on the stakes of this election for people, for the country, and for our democracy. Today, we're talking about a landmark case that the Supreme Court is taking on. Last Thursday, the justices heard arguments in a case all about presidential immunity. At the heart of the case is whether former President Donald Trump is immune from charges related to efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The case is a first for the Supreme Court that could impact not only the former president, but future presidents, as stated by Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
This case has huge implications for the presidency, for the future of the presidency, for the future of the country, in my view.
And the timing is just as significant as the outcome, with the November election just 6 months away. So what exactly happened on Thursday? What kind of impact will the outcome of this hearing have? I'm Jen White, in studio with 1A's Todd Zwillick, and you're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We'll be back with our panel in just a moment. Let's meet our panel. Joining us today is Mary McCord. She's the Executive Director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. She's also a professor of law at Georgetown University and the co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
Also with us is Leah Littman. She's the co-host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny and a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. Leah, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So on Thursday, the Supreme Court took 3 hours to hear arguments. Mary, what was the core question they were trying to answer?
Well, the question presented was really whether and to what extent a former president is criminally immune for acts taken within the scope of his official acts as a president. And that's the way the court had articulated the question that it wanted to hear from the parties on. But we heard a whole lot more than that, I think, over the course of the 3 hours.
Well, I just want to point out the fact that the court has a conservative majority, thanks to former President Trump. He appointed 3 of those justices, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch. Leah, after hearing Thursday's line of questioning, what sense did you get about how the justices are leaning?
It was a little bit difficult to know where exactly a majority would be. I think it is clear there is no majority to simply agree with and let stand the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit's opinion, which had held that once a former president leaves office, the president is not entitled to immunity for violating criminal laws while he or she was in office. It's clear that there are not 5 votes just to let that opinion stand and the trial to proceed. And the question is really, what are 5 justices going to coalesce around when they send the case back down to the lower courts and likely ask them to make some additional determinations before allowing the case to proceed any further?
Now, Justice Samuel Alito posed a line of questioning that revealed a bit about his thoughts on the case.
If an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy? And we can look around the world and find countries where we have seen this process.
That was Justice Alito speaking during oral arguments on Thursday. Mary, what insights did you gather from the justices' line of questioning on where they may stand on presidential immunity?
Well, directly related to that quote from Justice Alito, it seemed that there was a contingent of justices, Justice Alito, Justice Kavanaugh, and Justice Gorsuch, who had the concern that we just heard. If there isn't immunity, will presidents, all future presidents, be chilled in their ability to function as president because of their concern about a future prosecution? In fact, would that even lead to presidents trying to self-pardon on their last day of office or at the end of office? There was a separate contingent of justices who had the opposite concern, which was articulated by Justice Jackson when she said, if the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office? And I do think this is a concern here as we look toward an opinion. If the justices decide that there is some category of official acts for which a president is immune from criminal prosecution, what would anything within that category would essentially be what Justice Jackson was worried about, mm-hmm. things that a president could do without worry about criminal prosecution. Now, I'll say I agree with Leah that I didn't hear five votes who were ready to affirm the D.C. Circuit and say a president is not immune from criminal liability, period. I also didn't hear five votes that says he's immune for everything he does within the outer perimeter of his official acts. So I think that, you know, the whole question here is going to be, where is the line drawn? And I would say one thing, there is another option here. Everyone agrees that the president is a former president, is criminally liable for things done private acts, mm-hmm. things that were not done in his official capacity. And there is an ability here for the court to rule narrowly and not have to answer all of the difficult questions that it would if it really wants to create a rule for the ages, as Justice Gorsuch says. They don't need to do that. They can say whatever the meets and bounds of official acts. In this case, the allegations here were not within the scope of the president's outer perimeter of the president's official acts.
And we'll drill down a little bit more into how they're trying to draw this distinction between official and private acts a little later.
Leah, you mentioned that there wasn't a lot of controversy in the lower courts. Mary, you just said the court can rule narrowly here. I mean, the lower courts ruled decisively that there's no immunity for criminal prosecution for former presidents, and that immunity isn't mentioned anywhere in the law. It's not in the Constitution. Leah, why are justices seeming to reach out to put their own mark on a question that until now wasn't controversial? It certainly wasn't controversial in the lower courts.
I think it's a little bit difficult to know why exactly they are doing what they are doing in this case, but I want to underscore something that Mary said, which I think speaks to what they might be up to here, which is this particular case just does not require them to opine on what possible limits there might be on criminal prosecutions of former presidents. Because as Justice Sotomayor noted in her questioning with Trump's lawyer, there just isn't any plausible account of a president's official duties that encompass allegedly refusing to leave office, contesting the results of a valid election, and putting together a fraudulent slate of electors. No matter what the outer bounds of the president's office is and the president's official duties, that just wouldn't be encompassed in that and therefore wouldn't be entitled to immunity and wouldn't bar prosecution. And so I think the interesting and in many respects troubling question here is why were so many Republican appointees seemingly intent on using this case to opine on broader legal questions that this case doesn't require them to adjudicate? Because, of course, one consequence of their doing so in this case is to effectively immunize Donald Trump before the election and by guaranteeing additional legal process before any trial can pick up, they are ensuring there will not be a trial before the election on these election interference charges. And that is a very, again, troubling prospect. And given that they are, again, opining on legal questions that are not necessarily teed up by this case, it is very unclear what is going on here.
Mary, what does the Constitution say about presidential power?
Well, certainly in the article just mentioned, the section just mentioned, there is that take care clause. I would also indicate that there is a clause that is about the term of office. A president serves a term of office until for 4 years and does not serve after that unless he has been reelected. And, you know, this is one reason I think that the special counsel in his brief says, to echo Leah's point, that petitioner, meaning Donald Trump's concern about chilling official conduct that violates the provisions of the Constitution rings hollow because no president has an Article II interest in using crimes to give himself a second term after an election he lost. I would also note that one of the issues that came up at argument was whether there could be some things that a former president would be immune from that not because he has immunity. In fact, I misspoke when I used that term, but could not be criminally prosecuted for because application of a criminal statute to particular conduct might infringe on a president's core constitutional responsibilities. Things like the pardon power, the veto power, recognizing foreign governments, a very core small scope of things.
Let's go to a quick break here. Coming up, selling nuclear secrets, ordering a coup, misusing SEAL Team 6. The Supreme Court justices come up with hypotheticals for presidential immunity. Stay with us. We've got a lot more to get to. Let's get back to the conversation. There was a lot of talk about what qualified as an official act versus a personal or a private act. And here's Justice Amy Coney Barrett questioning former President Trump's lawyer John Sauer on where Trump's acts landed.
Even if we were to decide or assume that there was some sort of immunity for official acts, that there were sufficient private acts in the indictment for the trial to go, for the case to go back and the trial to begin immediately. And I want to know if you agree or disagree about the characterization of these acts as private. Petitioner turned to a private attorney, was willing to spread knowingly false claims of election fraud to spearhead his challenges to the election results. Private?
As alleged, I mean, we dispute the allegation, but
of
that
course.
Sounds private to me.
Sounds private. Petitioner conspired with another private attorney who caused the filing in court of a verification signed by petitioner that contained false allegations to support a challenge.
That private. Also sounds private.
This is something on lots of your minds. Michael emails, when you are the president, there is no point when you take off the cape. Your personal and professional lives are, in essence, merged. The court will be leading us down a ridiculous path to try to distinguish official and personal acts. And Dave in Silver Spring emails, withholding funds from an ally is a presidential act. Urging individuals to riot and disrupt government proceedings is not a presidential act. It is personal. I mean, Leah, try to explain the distinction the justices were trying to tease out here between private versus official acts.
Sure. So I guess I would start out by saying, on some level, this is not one of the difficult cases if you are going to try to separate out official from private conduct. You know, if you think about the things that Donald Trump has bragged that he can do with no accountability, you know, he once speculated that he could go out and shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and experience no accountability. So if he just did that, you know, like while president, that would ostensibly be a completely private activity. But, you know, if he involved, let's say, the military or SEAL Team 6, you know, in order to do so for someone else, then, you know, he would be abusing the office in order to accomplish that unlawful objective. But what I think Justice Barrett's questions are getting at, and which is important, is that even Donald Trump and his team concede that the indictment that Special Counsel Jack Smith brought alleges multiple bases for criminal liability that do not involve official activity. Here you have, as Justice Barrett was recounting, Donald Trump engaging a lawyer in private practice in order to benefit Trump as a candidate, not as an actual office holder, someone who wanted to obtain the office of the presidency again. So there are going to be situations and circumstances where, even though, of course, sometimes the president's official duties will blur together with the president's personal capacity, some instances and occasions, it will be clear that the president is not actually acting within the scope of the president's duties in particular.
Well, you mentioned SEAL Team 6, and back in January, Trump's legal team argued that ordering SEAL Team 6 to kill a political opponent would qualify for presidential immunity. And SEAL Team 6 was brought up again by Justice Samuel Alito.
I don't want to slander SEAL Team 6 because they're honorable. They're honorable officers, and they are bound by the Uniform Code of Military Justice not to obey unlawful orders. But no, I think one could say that it's not plausible that is legal, that that action would be legal. And I'm sure I've thought of lots of hypotheticals. I'm sure you've thought of lots of hypotheticals where a president could say, I'm using an official power, and yet the president uses it in an absolutely outrageous manner.
Mary, what did you make of this argument in this moment?
Well, it's two interesting points about that. One is that Mr. Trump's lawyer, John Sauer, really wasn't willing to give it up, you know, and even suggest that that would be too outrageous and not legally plausible. In fact, later in a response to a question from Justice Kagan about what if a president orders a coup, Mr. Sowers said, well, if we follow what Justice Alito said, that might fall outside of, you know, what is plausibly legal. But then he went on to say, if one adopts the test that we advance on behalf of Mr. Trump, that might well be an official act. And he would have to be, as I'll say in response to all these kinds of hypotheticals, he would have to be impeached and convicted before he could be criminally prosecuted. Because, of course, that's his position. So he takes a very extreme position. But I do think what Justice Alito was suggesting, I mean, it would be a very small number of things that would be carved out that wouldn't be protected. It wouldn't be under something like this outrageous or not even plausibly legal use of your official powers. But even under that test, I think there's an argument that what Donald Trump did here, going back to Leah's point, is just outrageous and not plausibly legal.
We got this email from Chris in West Virginia who says, I'm confused. Why can't SCOTUS focus on the case before it rather than attempt to develop a test, quote, for the ages, as Justice Gorsuch said? Lawyers described the lower court decision as right and tight. Why are they ignoring that? And Leah, I admit that I'm confused, too, in so many ways. Why is the Supreme Court striving to answer a question that nobody asked? Certainly the special counsel didn't ask it.
It is really quite remarkable, and it's remarkable for at least two reasons. One is something that we have already kind of talked about, which is that this particular case just does not require the court to opine on what exactly the limits are on the ability to prosecute former presidents for doing things that plausibly fall within the scope of the outer bounds of their official duties, because the indictment in this case just doesn't concern activities or matters that fall within the reasonable, plausible, or remote bounds of a president's official duties. Again, refusing to leave office allegedly, contesting the results of a valid election, putting together a fraudulent slate of electors, none of that is plausibly within the scope of the president's constitutional duties or any duties that are given to the president by statute. And then there's a second way in which the court seems intent on expanding this case, and that is by injecting additional questions into the case. That is, aside from determining whether the president might be immune from some set of criminal prosecutions relating to the president's official duties, some number of justices seem to want to use this case to put out legal questions about whether the Constitution might prohibit applying certain statutes to the president's core official duties. That is, in addition to this question of immunity, some justices were interested in potentially opining on the question about whether Article 2 of the Constitution means that certain federal criminal laws cannot apply to the president when the president is acting within the scope of their official duties. It's not even clear that that question is part of any appeal about immunity, nor is it clear that that question needs to be answered in this particular case. Again, given that this particular indictment does not concern matters within the president's core Article II powers. Other justices were floating whether they should use this case to say, well, maybe we should announce a general rule that no criminal law should apply to the president unless the statute explicitly lists the president as among the group of people who are subject to the criminal law. And that, too, is not necessarily part of an appeal that is supposed to be concerned with immunity, and yet the justices seemed interested in that question as well. And I think all of that suggests a court that is way too focused on the interests of one particular litigant, Donald Trump, to the exclusion of the broader consequences to our constitutional democracy.
Mary, Trump's lawyer, John Sauer, cited the 1982 case Nixon v. Fitzgerald as a test case in this question over presidential immunity. Explain what that case covers, and then we'll pick it up after the break.
That case was a civil case. So in contrast to a criminal prosecution, that was someone who sued civilly. And that is the case where the Supreme Court adopted this test, which is the test that Mr. Sauer wants it to apply here in a criminal case, which is that the president is immune from civil liability for acts taken within the outer perimeter of his official acts. And that's a capacious reading. So anything that sort of touches upon things that presidents can do, they can make appointments, they can, set policy for their departments and agencies, et cetera. That's where there's civil immunity, and that's what Mr. Sauer wants the Supreme Court to apply to criminal prosecutions.
We'll pick it up after the break. And still to come, what happens if the Supreme Court delays the decision on Trump's immunity until after the election?
So, Mary, before the break, you were talking about Nixon v. Fitzgerald. It came up in the oral arguments. Donald Trump's lawyers are interested in this case as a test case. And just to recap very briefly, Richard Nixon got sued in 1982. The court went to work and said presidents are immune from civil cases, being sued essentially, if the actions in question are part of their official duties as president, within the outer bound of their official duties as president, but not for personal stuff. And Donald Trump's lawyers said, hey, court, this is a great way for you to think about this case. So let's pick that up. How effective is Nixon v. Fitzgerald as a test case in the case of Donald Trump's alleged criminality?
Well, I want to answer that, but I want to also make a point when we talk about what Mr. Trump's attorneys are arguing. Even though they argue that the Fitzgerald test is the test that should apply, they still claim that a president would have to be impeached and convicted before he could ever be criminally prosecuted for anything within the scope of his official acts. So, he's got an added layer of difficulty here that frankly didn't seem to get any headway with the court. But to your question about should this be an applicable test, I think that, the courts below rejected that. The special counsel's brief, of course, explains reasons why that test doesn't make sense in the criminal prosecution realm. I didn't really hear a lot of justices suggesting that would be the right test. And here's why. In the civil realm, the idea, remember, we're talking there about lawsuits that might be for money damages, lawsuits that might be brought by some sort of political appointee who, got fired by a president who's now arguing he should be reinstated, those types of cases. It could be cases brought by litigants for things that the president did before he was even president, right? Imagine with Donald Trump, there's lots of people who said, look, I worked for him and I didn't get paid, on and on and on.
Lots of them have said that, actually.
Lots of them.
They are
exactly.
Legion.
Right. And so what the court was saying in Nixon v. Fitzgerald was, look, we can't have a president while he's president being tied up with all of this sort of litigation going on for all of these various civil things that people might be motivated to bring frivolous cases, just to distract the president. And the presidency is far too important to be distracted by those things. So a president is immune. Now, granted, when I mentioned things that would happen before he's president, those couldn't be within the outer scope of the official acts. I just illustrate that there's a lot of concern with a president having to deal with private litigation. So even things within the scope of his official acts, those are the things that he couldn't be civilly liable for while president. But in the criminal realm, we're talking about someone, again, going back to the Constitution, who is not taking care that the laws be faithfully executed. We're talking about someone who has actually violated or is alleged to have violated the criminal law. And so the concerns about, distracting a president, et cetera, are just not the same here. And we also remember we're not talking about a prosecution while the person is sitting as president. The Department of Justice has long taken the position you cannot criminally prosecute a sitting president. You would have to wait till after he is no longer president. So we're not talking about distracting him or anything like that. We're talking about holding him accountable for violations of the criminal law and making sure that he is not above the law.
This is from Larry in California. I'm not a lawyer or familiar with all the legal wrangling that goes on with cases, but why would the Supreme Court of the United States kick back such an important case to a lower court? I'm assuming for clarification or further rulings. I would think that since they are our Supreme Court, they should be making the decision on such an important ruling. Can't they figure it out for themselves, Leah?
So there are instances where it is, I think, appropriate for the Supreme Court to send a case back down to a lower court. So imagine, for example, that the Supreme Court comes up with a totally new legal test that it wants the lower courts to apply when, for example, determining whether certain conduct falls within the scope of the president's official duties. You might want a lower court to take the first crack at applying that legal standard, and then the Supreme Court can subsequently review their application of the legal standard after the district court, who is closer to the facts, has the opportunity to develop any additional facts that might be necessary to apply the new legal standard. And then the Court of Appeals has the opportunity to review it. And then the U.S. Supreme Court can review it again. And so as a matter of legal practice and sound institutional practice, it's not uncommon for, in some cases, the Supreme Court to say, you, lower court, need to take another look at this case, but under this new legal standard that we, Supreme Court, have established, and then leaving it to the lower courts to apply that new legal standard. I think why it's unnecessary in this case is that no matter what precise definition the Supreme Court adopted of the president's outside bounds of official duties, it's not difficult to determine that Special Counsel Jack Smith's indictment just does not concern matters that are plausibly within the scope of the outer bounds of the president's authority. And so there's no need to ask the lower courts to do additional factual development or to apply that legal standard to tricky facts, because it's just not that difficult of a legal question.
Yeah, well, now we're deep into this question of timing, right? How fast will all of this go? Will Donald Trump face accountability before the election? Phil in Massachusetts emails to say, if SCOTUS sends this case back to the D.C. court with Judge Tanya Chutkan for further testimony on what is personal versus what is official acts by the president, does the Supreme Court decision limit or restrict the D.C. judge to having to either go to a full trial or just a hearing alone? Leah, I think what Phil is getting at is what you've alluded to a couple of times. If the Supreme Court says we have a new test, lower court, figure out which of these charges is official, which of these charges is personal, that just means it goes pretty slowly, right?
Well, it adds an additional layer of legal process that the lower court would have to engage in before beginning any trial. Remember that before the Supreme Court took this case, Judge Tanya Chutkan had suggested that there would have to be about 80 or so days of pretrial proceedings in order to begin any trial on the election interference charges. As the two sides work out, you know, possible limits on what evidence can be introduced, what kinds of instructions the jury is going to receive on that evidence, and other matters to be sorted out pre-trial. So if you take those 80 days and then you imagine that the U.S. Supreme Court tells the lower court, well, you also have to engage in an analysis of whether there are any parts of the indictment that fall within the scope of the president's official duties and therefore can't be the basis of criminal liability, and if so, whether they could nonetheless be introduced as evidence for some other purpose or purposes, then that would add to the likely 80 days that the judge had indicated would probably be needed for pretrial processes before any trial begins. And that just makes the possibility of a trial before the election pretty unlikely.
We heard from Katie in Ohio, who emails, I was surprised that while arguing to a bunch of originalists, the intent of the framers to avoid having a king was not introduced. To me, this alone would show a lack of intent for a president to be immune from criminal prosecution. And Phil in Florida emails, if the aim is to grant complete immunity to presidents, and there is no mention of this in the Constitution, shouldn't this require a constitutional amendment? Mary, what do you think?
So that's so interesting because Justice Kagan picked up on a very similar point and said the framers did not put an immunity clause into the Constitution. They knew how to do so. There were immunity clauses in some state constitutions, and they didn't do it nevertheless. So I think it's a good point. But the fact is, this other immunity we were just discussing under Fitzgerald, the immunity from civil liability, that's also not in the Constitution, but it's something that the Supreme Court has sort of read into it based on separation of powers principles, as well, the idea of executive privilege, right? This has been litigated now several times, including in the Trump v. Thompson case, the case that involved the House Select Committee's request for presidential records, where Mr. Trump claimed executive privilege, even though his claims were denied there and the House Select Committee was able to obtain those records. This idea of executive privilege, the privilege to not have to, you know, provide information to Congress or to a courts, that also is not in the Constitution, but it's been something that the Supreme Court has nevertheless interpreted as covered by the Constitution under separation of powers principles. So I take the caller's point, and I'm very sympathetic to it, but this is a, you know, part of a line of immunities and privileges for presidents that the Supreme Court has developed over decades now. But I think what you saw here is Justice Kagan and other justices pushing back on applying that to criminal responsibility.
Well, as we ruminate over the timing here. I mean, the bottom line, Leah, what do you think are the stakes if the Supreme Court doesn't send this case back to the lower courts in such a manner that allows for a trial before the election? What does that mean for voters? What does that mean for the rest of us?
It is really difficult to overstate the stakes of this case. I mean, there is a possibility that the Supreme Court is going to suggest that there are some matters that fall within the scope of the president's official duties that cannot be subject to the laws, criminal laws at all. There's some possibility that they will suggest that the president's official duties to which the president might be entitled to some immunity include a refusal to leave office, efforts to interfere with the result of a valid election, and potentially putting together a fraudulent slate of electors. I think all of that should be deeply concerning, as is the possibility that the court is slow-walking this case, has been slow-walking this case, use the oral argument to inject additional legal questions into this case in order to prevent the American people from being able to have a jury of Donald Trump's peers decide whether he engaged in unlawful election interference the last time he was in office before they decide whether to put him in that office again.
We have just a minute left here, but I'd briefly like to hear from both of you what this means for future presidents. This is not just about former President Trump. Mary?
So it's interesting because both parties came into this with opposite views. Mr. Sauer arguing for Mr. Trump that, you know, you have to have immunity or you're never going to have a president who can actually take the bold action that's required to be president. Yet for all of our history, that hasn't been a problem, right? That hasn't stopped presidents from taking the bold action that they need to take when it's required to execute their different constitutional responsibilities, including responsibilities that have to do with our engagements overseas, et cetera. The other side, of course, as we talked about earlier, was very concerned that if you grant some sort of broad immunity, then you've really just given a license to future presidents to break the law with impunity. And that's a pretty concerning and alarming prospect.
Leah, your thoughts in just a sentence or two?
I'd add that it is about what Justice Jackson called whether to make the office of the president effectively a crime center.
And we will leave it there. That's Leah Littman, the co-host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny and a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. Also with us, Mary McCord, the executive director at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection. She's also a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center and co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.